Remember Hawkeye?
I do. Jeremy Renner.
Oh, what are your okay? Would be no.
Real quick, what are your honest thoughts on Jeremy Renner?
I don't know, he's all right.
As an actor, not as a person, not as the weirdo with the Renner app. You know what I mean?
He's fine. He's a fine, generic action guy.
I like him in a couple dramas. I like him in that Sheridan movie with Elizabeth Olsen.
Wind, I haven't seen that.
Wind River, yeah, the Boomer movie.
He's good in Arrival. Like, he's all right.
Oh,
in Arrival.
Yeah.
Good. Like, yeah, he brings the right energy to that.
The right Renergy, some would say.
Some would. I haven't seen The Hurt Locker.
Hey, that's good, too. Catherine Bigelow. European Gigolo. Rob Schneider reference.
Not right. Hitting.
Let's start the show. And let's start the show.
Rob what?
Rob Schneider. The man.
Making me Google shit.
The man from that movie where he trades places with a 16-year-old girl and he goes, somebody shit in the locker.
Okay. Sure.
This means nothing to you. I'm sorry.
No. Deuce Bigelow, male gigolo. Okay.
Yep. Okay. Schneider. That's not the movie where he says the shit in the locker thing, though. Just. It's a different movie.
But what also, gigolo already implies male. Why is it male gigolo? A gigolo is a male prostitute.
And they made multiple gigolo movies.
Oh shit, Deuce Bigelow, European.
Yeah, that's why. Yep. Mm-hmm. That's literally me in the future. Okay, we should start. Naturally, I've been recording for 2 minutes, so we'll just keep going.
Great. Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
The next movie club is The Hot Chicks.
Oh, The Hot Chick, Schneider. The Hot Chick. That's the one.
The Hot Chick.
Trades places with the girl.
Or we could also do The Bench Warmers.
Another, I like that one too. Is that logged on Letterboxd for me?
The Animals. The Water Boy.
Water Boy.
The Ridiculous Six.
We gotta start. We gotta start the show. We can't go down this route. Okay, here we go. Madame, est-ce que je peux aller à la toilette, s'il vous plaît? I did French for 4 years in high school, and welcome to episode 90. Yeah. 90 of Large Popcorn, a space where friends gather around to have elevated and comfortable discussions about all things film, or in this case today, cinema. For those of you who don't know, I am one of your co-hosts, Christian Macias, and alongside me, as always, Letterboxd fiend, David Lynch lover, Italian, Cinestallion, Ugo Pinay.
Donde está la biblioteca?
Why is that the default Spanish phrase? Come on.
I did Spanish in high school for 4 years. No, actually, I did do Spanish for 3 years.
Give me something real. Give me something you would actually say in Spanish. You know what I mean? If you're in Mexico and you need to use a phrase, what are you going to use?
Mi novia está embarazada.
Oh my God. Congratulations. If that were real. She's not. Yeah. Mi novia está embarazada. Where did you pull that from?
I don't know.
That's wild.
Came to me.
Yeah.
Imbarazada is a funny word because in Italian it's similar to the English. It's embarrassed, but imbarazzato. And it means pregnant in Spanish. So it stuck with me. I don't know. I can read Spanish, and if you speak to me in Spanish, I'll mostly understand what you're saying, but I can't speak very well.
Let's be real.
Does that make sense?
Let's be real. If I showed up in Italy, would you have a good time with me? Have a beer?
Oh, yeah.
Show me that theater with the blue like tear on or whatever?
I would not bring you to the theater.
This is just like the Limax.
It's the Laymax. It's the shitty, shitty, crappy digital projection theater is what we call it.
What is beer in Italian? It's not cerveza, is it? Birra.
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 2 hours.
Birra Pompino. Birra Pompino.
No.
I shouldn't say that.
That's a good time would be, but you know.
You know what else is a good time? This podcast, folks, remember that Large Popcorn is your movie podcast where we talk about the latest. Wow, we haven't even talked about movies yet, I think. Where we talk about the latest in cinema world news, as well as anything and everything movies.
Well, we talked about theaters. That's close enough.
Yeah, close enough. If you like what you hear, God, I hope you do, please give us a sub on your favorite podcast service of choice. And remember to leave a review because that does indeed help us out. If you have any questions, you can DM them directly to Large Popcorn Pod over on Twitter, or you can dial in at speakpipe.com/largepopcorn. You can leave us a message there and we'll play it live for you on the show, respond to you. But until then, a new episode of LP goes live every other Tuesday, except for next week. Stick around, we got a surprise for you. So we sincerely hope that you stick around. And as always, all the resources and items we discuss in today's show will be down in the show notes slash description below. Check it. There's a video of Greta Gerwig in the show notes today. Reminders. This episode is part of the One Inch Barrier, an international movie series happening all summer long, where each episode we travel to a different country to explore cinema from around the world. And stay tuned at the end of the show to find out where we're traveling to next. No passports required. Only the love of movies. For now, let's get into our short segments of the day, starting with recent watches. Hugo, tell me, what have you been watching?
Not that much this time. I watched a few Mission Impossible. I mean, we'll talk about Mission Impossible in a minute, but sure. Of course I went to see that. I also went to see Ponyo in theaters, the Miyazaki movie, and it was amazing. Just seeing those movies, just the movement of them on a giant screen is just something that I hadn't. I mean, I had seen when I was like 5 years old. I think they took us to see Spirited Away, and we were all terrified of it.
Wow, that's cool.
With school, like I remember with my class, I barely remembered anything from it. I just remember being really scared by it. So this is the first time that I'm actually seeing a Miyazaki film in theaters, and it was awesome.
You're going to hate me, but the theaters in America, some of the bigger chains, they have these things called Fandango events. Have you heard of Fandango? Yeah. And they have...
I know more or less what it is. Yeah.
Website, book movies, tickets through, whatever. And they have these Fandango events, and every year they'll do like a Studio Ghibli series, usually in the summer, where they just play them like all summer long. And I still have yet to catch a single Studio Ghibli movie in the theaters ever in my life. That's a shame.
No. You should. That's what they're doing here. They're showing some Miyazaki movies this summer. And they're doing Ponyo, they're doing Kiki. I think they're doing Castle in the Sky, which we'll go see. They're doing The Wind Rises, which we might go see. That's
and,
pretty cool.
And you're almost done with
your... Weird, too, because they... It, for some reason, they're not like the way they're marketing it is. Studio Ghibli masterpieces, but nobody's mentioning that there's a new Ghibli movie that is gonna come out. So they could have attached the marketing. Oh, come see some Miyazaki movies because the new one is coming out by the end of the year ish. But they didn't. Didn't do that.
It must.
So it's very like they clearly chose to do this because there's a new one coming out, but. Without mentioning it for some reason. They just think people don't know, I guess. Well,
the thing is, like, I don't know, they might have cut that like a long time ago in advance, you know, and then they have to distribute that. Who knows, like, if they've even like even acquired distribution rights beforehand, you know?
Oh, no. There wouldn't be distribution, but just even as a marketing thing to get people to come see your pre-releases, you know? There was quite a few people actually in seeing Ponyo, and it was like a Thursday afternoon, so that was pretty cool. But anyway, I mean, Ponyo, great movie. It's beautiful. So cool. And I also watched Asteroid City, which I loved. 4.5 stars from me. it's just so beautiful to look at, and it's like it's got this meta narrative element.
I knew your ass would like that. I knew your ass would like that so much.
It's so good. It's so good. I enjoyed it so much. It's
you just logged it right now.
Like, yeah, I forgot to log it last night. It's wrestling with what like the meaning of the stories that we tell even is. And it's got melancholia in it, but it's also quite funny. There's a self-reflection on, you know, the work of Wes Anderson himself. There's so much going on in it. I feel like I have to see it 14 times to fully grasp everything about it, but I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. I had a great time watching it.
Here you go.
Loved the little title cards. Act 3 to be played relentlessly. Like it's great.
Don't forget, beautiful. Hugo, whenever you feel down, you can't dream if you don't fall asleep.
It's true. And you can't wake up if you don't fall asleep.
That's that. There you go. That was the quote. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's been a minute for me. It's been a minute for me.
No, but yeah, it's movies are dreams that you'll never forget. They say in The Fablemans. And I think it's a movie about movies, but not only about movies. It's more about just storytelling, the idea of why we tell stories and why it matters. And I thought it was pretty great. Incredible cast. Like even the small roles would be someone, you know, doing the best acting they can do in this one scene. Jason Schwartzman and Scarlett Johansson are, I would say, the kind of the emotional core of the film, and they're both just incredible. Wes Anderson movies don't get a lot of considerations for awards lately, but I feel like this will get some technical stuff, because how do you not give this movie a production design nomination? Like, you have to, and I hope they do.
There were some cool like little vignettes shared on Twitter after the movie came out of like them doing, you know, like the sets, like for the movie, and like it's so, I don't know, cool seeing the little miniature train with like the tiny camera go by, and it's like this movie making in general is it's lovely to see the art form like behind the scenes.
And I love how it doesn't try to look realistic at all. Like it's completely artificial, and that's the point. I mean, I wrote this in my review for Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which we'll talk about, but like movies now really want to look realistic always, and I think a lot of the time they really don't need to, and choosing to have a more heightened world I think often benefits them and makes them more interesting and more I don't know, there's I know I'm watching a movie, like you don't have to make it look as dreary as the real world for me to feel immersed, you know. I think going more animated and picking a visual style that is not completely realistic, I think often makes your movie stand out rather than feeling just unrealistic. Even, you know what I mean? Obviously, it depends on genre, but
this is what Greg Fraser knew when he made the Batman, another Batman reference. Absolutely, but like, come on, like it's a dark movie, but it's still like soaked in like reds and blues. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
there's still very much color present in that. Yeah, I'm with you. Mm-hmm. Aren't you missing one?
A movie.
A little Tom Cruise joint.
No, I said it. I said, oh, we'll talk about Mission Impossible in a minute.
Not that
one.
Oh,
what the fuck? Oh, yeah, I guess I watched The Last Samurai as well. I didn't think that would be worth mentioning. It's all right. It's good. It's fun.
That's all you need to say, you know? I just want to keep you honest.
There isn't much to it. It's like a someone from the West trying to make a samurai movie, and there's some cool sequences in it, but I don't know. Doesn't quite nail it, I don't think.
Yeah. Hit me up when you watch that Great Wall of China movie with Matt Damon. Saw you tweeting about
that
too. Dude,
I actually kind of want to see that, because it's that's Zhang Yimou. Like, it's the director of Hero and House of the Flying Daggers. And Fall River Red, which is a movie that came out this year and made $700 million in China and nobody even knows about. that I want to see as soon as it's available. It's like the third highest grossing movie of the year, and we don't even know it exists, which is funny.
That's crazy.
It's same director, so I kind of do want to see the Great Wall of China movie, even though it's probably not really good.
Knowing your ass, you'll still give it at least like 3.5.
It's possible, yeah.
Cool action. Why not? Screw it.
Well, this movie is 3.5 hours, and there's one cool action scene, 3.5 stars.
Nice. Is it 3.5 hours? No.
No, probably
okay.
not.
Okay, oh, thank God. Because if you give it 3.5, I'm like, okay, well, I'm adding this to my watch list.
What have you watched?
Nothing. I've been working on a project. Hold on. I've been working on a project, so I've been kind of immersed in that. And then I've been ending my nights with reading. Been reading again. It helps me, I don't know, helps me unwind, helps me think about writing in different ways. So picked up a new book. And I decided to stop playing Final Fantasy for now, because I wanted to actually get into a show. A long time ago, so the project I'm working on pulls heavy inspiration from a book. Robert W. Chambers is The King in Yellow. And at some point I remembered that HBO's season one of True Detective with Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson also pulls heavily from The King in Yellow and just the overall Southern Gothic. So I was like, you know what? I have nothing to watch right now. I'm going to be watching a lot of new release movies. I'm going to just start this show. It's only 6 episodes long. And, you know, I'm only going to watch it for the first season. The other seasons are different, I think, storyline. So it doesn't matter, right?
Dude, every season is its own thing, right?
Yeah. And 3 episodes in, it's like, dude, this is like exactly the kind of, you know, psychological noir thriller that I kind of look for. And it is extremely like sweaty in the Southern Gothic, where it's like the past will not let us go. And everyone just is like complete pieces of shit, where like they get worse and like their characterizations just get worse as you continue watching the show. And I mean, without giving any kind of plots away, it's like a spiral into that kind of the violence and the underworld of this Louisiana state, this case that they're working, and just like the overall exploration of these characters, it just keeps getting worse. And it's great, dude. I was gonna eat my pancakes and watch another episode, but you were ready to go, so I was like, you know, it's fine, I'll watch it some other time.
Okay. It's like a serial killer story, right?
Yeah, without giving it away. Okay.
Yeah,
and it's cool. Explain, you got it. And it's
making, like that, actually,
yeah. One of my favorite subgenres of movies is just overall crime thrillers. You know, I think of Prisoners. I think of, you know, Fincher's as well. And it makes me excited for, we're getting another Fincher movie this year. We're getting The Killer. And I really hope it gets distribution, man. I really hope Netflix puts it in some theaters.
I mean, yeah, you'll get to see it in theaters probably.
Yeah, I don't know if you will.
They usually, no, I won't. I definitely won't. They usually put out their movies for like a week, in like 1,000 US theaters, so I'm sure Portland will have one of those.
I think, if I remember, seeing it somewhere, the Academy was thinking about making it mandatory for theatrical runs to extend more than just a couple of days. To do, I think it was like 14.
The current rule is a week. It has to be out for 1 week in the year before the Oscars. So like some movies will have the wide release in January, right, but the limited in like late December. And it has to be 1 week in LA. But yeah, 1 week is a bit stupid, isn't it? What they did last year with Glass Onion, it 1 week it made so much money.
and then they
just
ridiculous, you know,
took it off the table. It's really stupid.
They didn't like making money.
Netflix and loves losing money. That's what they're good at.
That's true.
And great. Fuck them.
But we did watch one movie in between episodes, right?
Mm-hmm.
One brand new movie. Let's get into our mini review of Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. Hugh, you're the action man. I would love for you to go first. Your thoughts on the movie?
I really enjoyed it. I didn't like super love it like I did. I think both Rogue Nation and Fallout are better films overall. There are some sequences in this that are insane, like all the whole train thing, without saying anything specific, is just ridiculously great. There are some moments of tension and cool dialogue scenes that I really enjoyed. At the same time, there are a lot of dialogue scenes, and the movie's quite long. And I don't know, it does feel like a part one, in some ways even more so than the Spider-Man. I think Spider-Man Across Spider-Verse has more of a, oh, the movie just ends out of nowhere. This has a bit more of a conclusion to the first part of the story, I think, than Spider-Man does. Like, it ends in a place where Spider-Man ends in a place where I think, oh, it should have ended 10 minutes earlier, and this bit should have been the beginning of the next movie. And this one, I understand why it ends where it ends, and I think it's a good sort of cliffhanger ending for the next one. The action sequences are as spectacular as ever. I think the villain is whatever. I like it in concept more than I like it in execution, I think. And I think they saved a lot of what the villain is going to be for the second movie.
Okay.
And I think the movie does kind of feel like that. It feels like, oh, we're setting up a bunch of cool shit, and then it doesn't, like, we need the next one to fully get it. But still, like, 4 stars, great action, the dialogue's fun, Tom Cruise and Simon Pegg especially get to be quite funny in quite a few sequences, and I enjoy that. At the same time, there's some very tense sequences. And there's one thing that I actually do not like.
But I know what you're thinking of. Spoilers. I know exactly what you're thinking of. And to respond to you, there's been some great discussions about that.
Why? I get it. It's,
We'll see.
I think, we'll see, but there's also, I don't know, this franchise has a bit of a thing going on that it gets a little weird with this one. And I feel like if you don't do that thing, it makes the movie tighter, because you might maybe have to cut out another backstory and you know, character arc and tighten up the ones that you have. But again, visually stunning, although it doesn't look as good as Fallout, because they switched to digital, and I think you can. I mean, it's great digital cinematography. I'm not even, like, it looks great. It doesn't look as good as Fallout, though. Fallout had some of those IMAX sequences where it's just breathtaking, and this one doesn't quite have that. So yeah, I'm at 4 stars, but it's like my 5th favorite Mission Impossible movie.
It's funny having it number 5 and still being as strong as it is.
Yeah, no, it's, yeah. I mean, they're all good. Except for 2, they're all good. So, whatever.
Yeah. I'm with you. My friend had asked me to make him a VM, a voice message, like, right after I got out of the movie. Like, in my car, on my way home, just, like, rant about my thoughts without spoiling anything. And I did. And I don't think my thoughts have changed since my initial, like, reaction to it, which is pretty much the exact same as you. I think coming out of it, I thought immediately my comparison is to Fallout, because I had just rewatched it. I think it's clearly the best one, in my opinion.
For me, it's Fallout and Ghost Protocol are the ones that are just the best.
Sure. And I felt that difference. There is a tension in Fallout, like, right at the beginning, that does not let go until the very end. Like, it is very much consistent. There are places where it kind of dips here and there.
I think there's also a better pacing of the action sequences themselves. This is quite backloaded.
And even in between, like, in Fallout, I'm going to reference Fallout again, in between, like, action scenes where we're going to transition into more of a dialogue scene, there are, like, cool moments where, like, when they're underneath the, like, tunnels and they're all in the boat in Fallout, bless you. There's, like, these, like, little drums, and it's like they remove the entire sound, and it's only the score that's operating, and we're just seeing, like, them, like, travel through the shadows. I'm like, this is cool.
Dead Reckoning never hit the highs to me of Fallout, despite it being like a great action movie with a narrative that I think is strong. Still need, yeah, like you said, I think there's a lot of setup for part two that I have to wait to see what it actually ends up being like. I think my strongest thing about Dead Reckoning is that it does have balls. There's a part of me at the beginning of the movie where I thought, is it going to stay this kind of slow and talky for a good chunk? And then the title card hits and it's like, okay, this is the setup that we're doing. They had the balls to like let it have time to breathe and set it up, and then have like 2 hours of just like, okay, here's the actual the IMF team going out to do the thing. And it's like, okay, I respect that, McHugh.
And I don't mind it being talky. I think, you know, some of these dialogue scenes are really good. But I don't think, like, I think some of them are just, well, we have this extra character that we have to give something to that kind of didn't need to be in the movie, even though they're really good as a performance and they're a cool character. But, like, if you think about what then happens in the movie and why they're introduced, it gets a little weird. You start feeling, oh, maybe there's a contract thing. Like, it kind of took me out of the movie. My immersion was broken a little bit. And I do think the movie could have been tightened if that wasn't there. And you know, you didn't have some of the extra dialogue scenes that I don't think were fully necessary. Although I do like some of the things. It's hard to talk around without spoiling, but
yeah.
I think the second part will really inform how I feel about the first part in a way that feels more so than movies like Dune or even Spider-Man or other movies like that. Because this, if the second part has the same problems as the first part, I might like the first part less as well. Sure. But if the second part brings the whole narrative together in a satisfying conclusion, then I might enjoy this more. You know what I mean? I'm kind of feeling suspended and just waiting to see what happens next.
I'll say this too as well. A lot of people talking about the action movie, rightfully so. The cool cliff jump scene, and obviously how like
so good, yeah.
How tactile the whole train sequence.
Why we needed to see all of it in marketing is a weird to me, but I get it.
Yeah, I'm with you there. By the time I was in the movie, I was like, okay, I ended up seeing way too much of this in marketing for what we got. However,
sure.
I would love to see more love online for might be the best car chase scene of the series. Fucking great, so, dude. And Palm Klementoff, I don't know how to pronounce the last name, is so good, dude. She's so great in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like her emotion, but with only a few lines and mostly her eyes, I thought was awesome.
Yep.
Did not know she had it like this in her.
I thought she was fantastic in the movie. I have seen some commentators saying she goes into this kind of trope of the silent Asian assassin, which is a thing in some Western action movies. But I've seen people debate on that, like Asian American reviewers and film writers and stuff. And some people are annoyed by it. Some people just say, oh, well, yeah, but she's so good, so who cares? So just putting that out there just so we know that is a thing. But like I thought she was fantastic, and she had very fun screen presence, I think.
Yeah, sure.
There's that one fight scene in Venice with her that is quite cool.
Yes. I think
visually very interesting.
I think for the thing for me, because I also saw the trope kind of discussion going around, and it's for me is like, yes, it is one I am totally understanding of the criticism, and in fact I probably even to an extent agree with it. I also simultaneously have to sustain that it is awesome to see women in action movies with like clear character development that in like major studio Hollywood like movies from other studios are like not getting. And in this one, we have like four.
Definitely, yeah. There's that one dialogue scene where all of them are together, and it's quite cool.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Oh. Yes, yes. Cool movie. 4 stars for me as well.
Same.
Okay. Let's move on over into real roundup. We got some movie news. for you this week. Barbie and Oppenheimer are out already by the time this recording drops. A lot of people have been seeing it. Barbie Rotten Tomatoes score, I think it was originally at a 94, 93. Why did this paste the wrong thing? It's now currently at an 89. A lot of people still loving it. Although, you know what? I'll say this. Twitter likes to be nonconformist. And there are the few tweets out there being like, oh, this movie's messy. And then same thing with Oppenheimer. It's like, oh, it's a Nolan blockbuster. And like, it's not that good. It's like, okay, whatever. Go be contrarian somewhere else. I'm excited for Barbie and Oppenheimer.
I'm very excited. My excitement for Oppenheimer is actually going really high.
Yes, yes, sir.
And it'll die down by the time I actually get to see it. But whatever. Yeah, I've been watching like interviews with Christopher Nolan and that type of thing, and it's just movie sounds cool.
A lot of people.
Barbie, I'm excited. Barbie, I will see this week at some point, so I'm very, very excited for it. And it seems like it's making the right people not angry, which is always good.
Yes, dude, absolutely. Yeah. That is the true mark.
Will be awful, but that's it. Is what it is.
I can't wait till Fox News gets a hold of the Barbie movie.
But apparently the guy, what's his name? Ted Cruz already said it's Chinese communist propaganda. So.
Fantastic. That means it's good.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. By the way, Oppenheimer sitting at a 92. And I'm excited. Mm-hmm. I had something to say and I can't remember what it is. Oh, I've seen comparisons to this, to Oppenheimer, to JFK. And saying, calling it like a talkie blockbuster. And I'm like, you know what?
I'm down for that.
And that should, when this is like this politically charged, come on, yeah.
And apparently they shot 100% of the movie in IMAX cameras. So just all of it, dialogue, everything is IMAX. Which is pretty cool.
Even, I've actually really been enjoying the like TikTok discovery of people who have like don't even know about like IMAX film or whatever. And like, IMAX has been doing some pretty cool videos on their feeds of them showing them just like loading up the film and delivering it. They delivered it to like a theater in, I don't know, maybe it was Texas, who knows, but somewhere in the States.
And the big giant reel.
Yeah. And they were like showing like what it's like to like, you know, what the film looks like and what it looks like when you set it up and it's running. It's like, this is cool. Like there's like a whole, there's a bunch of people out there who are like, don't know about IMAX film and like, or just film period. So,
yeah.
That's neat.
This is annoying, but I'm actually excited right now for the Blu-ray release of this movie.
The Blu-ray.
Because, like, I'll see it in theaters, but it's going to be a month late in Italian, no IMAX, shitty projection. And I'm kind of like, oh, I guess I could shell out for the 4K Blu-ray and actually see the IMAX image at least, because they usually, in Christopher Nolan movies, they put it on the physical release, so that'll kind of give me an idea what it's like. But yeah, I know I complain a lot about Italian theaters, but I'm sorry, but it's so annoying.
That's true. Yeah, I feel bad, man. I feel bad when you talk about it. Yeah. Well, yeah, so I'll be in LA, in the Chinese theater.
Great,
29 theaters in the world, and I'm at one of them, baby. I'm pretty close to the screen. I'm gonna be a little scared. I'm gonna blow up, dude. I'm gonna blow up.
Blow up. Or just fall in love with Cillian Murphy's eyes.
I love Cillian Murphy.
Yeah.
Everyone should watch Sunshine. Danny Boyle. Good movie. Mm-hmm. Also, by the way, I guess this is a good time as any. Speaking of Barbie and Oppenheimer, by the time this is out, surprise episode next week. Let's just say it right now. Barbenheimer is happening. And we'll see you at the movies.
Finally.
Next item. Hugo wrote this in. SAG joins the strike. Awful CEOs. What do you want to say about this?
Yeah. Just big important movie news. SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, has joined the WGA in the strike. So production on movies now is officially completely shut down, because I guess you could technically shoot without writers, but you definitely cannot shoot without actors. So now it's a war. Like, the studios are giving out incredibly awful quotes.
Yes.
Completely out of touch, saying stuff, oh, we're going to hold out until the writers lose their homes and saying that what they're asking for is ridiculous. Well, they have their cute $45 million a year bonuses at the end of the year. Yeah, Bob Iger, just fucking dick. But I mean, he's a CEO, so what do you expect? So just wanted to mention it. Support for all the people striking. And if you're a dumbass on Twitter who doesn't understand that the strike is not for millionaire actors, but that SAG has 160,000 members, and all they want is to increase the minimums for acting for union acting jobs, which they deserve because they're not making enough to get to the end of the month and pay their bills, and get normal residuals from streaming, because it used to be that you had a TV show and you would get residuals from viewership from that show, and streaming has really extremely reduced that. And then, of course, there's a concern with AI, where studios are trying to scan people and use their likeness forever, which is fucked up. So yeah, support for the strikers. I mean, Hollywood is shutting down now, which sucks, of course, for new releases, but that's what its strikes are supposed to do. So hopefully the studios understand that they can't work without the people who are actually making their products, who are way more important than this stupid millionaire CEOs. So,
did you see the, I think it was some documents on Twitter of back in, like, what I think it was SAG, like what they were proposing and what they heard they got back. And like some of them were like insane. It was like asking for more breaks or like food, and just says like rejected. Just straight rejected. Like, this is crazy. People are just like trying to have like a decent work environment.
Yeah, the working on film is 14-hour days and no breaks, and you might not have time to have lunch, and it's a struggle. And you know, of course, if you're, you know, fucking Robert Downey Jr. making $40 million on a movie, I'm working 14 hours for 3 months, but it's, you know, I'm being more than fairly compensated for this. But the people holding the boom mics and, you know, the people who are there on set as an extra, but they have to be there all day and making pennies, and everybody else involved should be compensated for the harsh work environment, and that work environment should be improved as much as possible. So, yeah, I think it's really ridiculous. When people online, I think, don't think people are being greedy, it's because they look at their own lives and they're like, oh, look, I'm working 60 hours a week and making not that much money. And
it shouldn't be that way.
Yeah. You should be striking too. Like, we're in support of you having better conditions too. And I think people just see things from such an individualistic point of view where, oh, I'm not, you know, I'm getting paid less than you, therefore you don't deserve to have better conditions, which is just besides the point. The whole point of unions is collective action, and people need to start thinking about that.
Shouldn't be that hard to pay these people.
No.
You would think. Yeah. One would think.
Yeah, with the amount of money that they're making at the top levels, they, you know, rescale budgets. Like, you have to rethink your budgets to pay people fairly and stop making movies that cost $300 million that are not going to make enough money to make a profit, and use the profits that you are going to make to actually pay the people who make your art. Cause without them, you're going to shut down in a year.
Let's move on. Our next item, Disney is downsizing TV assets potentially on sale. I actually didn't see this at all. Hugh, you put this in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, studios not in the best spot, definitely not in the spot that they can really hold out to not have any production going. Disney apparently is shopping around some of their TV assets, such as ABC, ESPN. I think they also own not the Discovery Channel, but something like that.
National Geographic, I think it is.
National Geographic, I think they own. All those TV assets they might be looking to sell if they can find them, because obviously they've been operating, like, Disney Plus has been a money loser, as have all streaming services in the last 3 years. I mean, there was that news going around about the budgets on those TV shows, and they're just pumping $200 million into Secret Invasion that nobody's watching. And it's like, and also, even if a lot of people were watching, what are you making money off of? Like, you're not going to get extra subscribers to your service because of Secret Invasion. So what's the incentive? It's just, it seems like a weird model that is destined to be completely rethought in the next few years, but we'll see.
I'm surprised that bubble has not burst already, but like, it seems like it's rapidly approaching it.
There was a big article earlier this year. I think it was Variety who reported on it, where basically studios had, you know, the usual calls with investors and stuff, and HBO Max, Disney Plus, Netflix, all of them just saying, oh, we're losing, throughout the pandemic, we lost like $2 billion and that's gone. Like, we've invested in this, and we're not getting it back anytime soon. And so theatrical supposedly should be the way that you try to make some of that money back, but we'll see how that evolves.
God, I hope.
Yeah. It's, people want everything on streaming because streaming has made them used to having everything on streaming, but it's not going to work out the way you think. Star Wars quote, second week in a row.
maybe if they like quit pulling movies that are making money from the theaters to put them on VOD, like Asteroid City, like what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks after they come out, maybe people would actually go see the actual movies.
I think there are, and I don't know anything, but there are some movies that seem obvious, like worldwide releases. It's been proven that this is selfish maybe, but like, it's been proven that when movies release at the same time everywhere in the world, they make more money from international markets, because there's no piracy, because people worldwide get excited for the same movie at the same time, because everything is online. And secondly, it's the budgets. It's, again, we talked about it last time for Indiana Jones, but even Mission Impossible broke the record for opening weekend in the Mission Impossible series, unadjusted for inflation. So obviously there's that to consider, but still, it did $80 million in the first 5 days, and it's probably going to lose money at the box office, despite breaking the record. Like, this movie made 230 something opening weekend worldwide, and it's considered a disappointment. So there's something that's not working there, and I think they'll have to rethink the way they spend money on movies. And a lot of it, because the crazy thing is, a lot of the spending is, we're going into this without a finished script, and we're just gonna do a bunch of CGI in post and figure it out in the edit. And that's just not a sustainable way to make movies, at least not all of them. Mission Impossible, kind of different, because obviously there was issues with COVID. It was the first movie to come back for COVID and all of that. But generally, the reason why these budgets are so inflated has also been that they're just not planning well.
Yep. No release dates, apparently. Paramount, we got Barbenheimer next week. It's gonna be eating into MI, sadly.
Yep. I don't know how that's going to make money, but we'll see. Apparently, Barbie and Oppenheimer are supposed to, are looking good for the box office, but I don't know.
Did you see what WB put on the schedule for December? They have 3 movies in 10 days.
No, I didn't see that.
It's like Wonka, The Color Purple, and another movie. Like, all back, like, I don't know. It has
to
be
some musicals.
Yeah, it's got to be some kind of, well, whatever, I'm not going to get into this. Studios suck.
Yeah. And it seems like they're kind of dumb as well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, some of these things are just like, they seem obvious. Like, you can't spend $320 million on a new Indiana Jones movie. Like, no shit.
One would think. Last bit of news here. I don't think we talked about this last time. How Do You Live? The most recent Miyazaki movie. It's got a new title for international release, The Boy and the Heron. And I gotta say it. I don't like it. I'm just gonna throw my opinion out there.
Title.
What is wrong
awful
with
title.
How Do You Live? I think that's a perfectly fine. It's also the name of the book that it was taking inspiration from. Just leave it as is. What?
It's very weird. I don't understand. But I mean, it's probably true that most Ghibli movies have a different title. If you look at the actual what the Japanese
fair.
Title is
fair,
but because this was. Had already received some level of marketing as How Do You Live? And there was no, you know, trailers and stuff, but like the movie was sold with the idea that it was called How Do You Live? Even in the West, like Ghibli themselves put out the title. The was like now changing it, I think, is just more confusing for people. But I mean, whatever.
Too concerned with SEO, these motherfuckers.
Yeah, it's just so. Yeah, and The Boy and the Heron is such the generic.
Yeah. Not very
title,
exciting.
Like. Must be 15 movies that are called The Boy and the Something. The Boy and the Beast is another animated movie from 5 years ago or something. But How Do You Live came out in Japan and got really positive reviews and made, I think it had the second highest opening for a Ghibli movie ever.
Incredible.
Despite having no marketing, which is great. Cool.
It came out and I immediately muted a bunch of words on Twitter because I don't want to see a single image of this movie before it comes out in the States.
There hasn't been one yet. Like even they haven't put out anything yet. There's that one image of that. What I assume at this point is the heron.
Yeah.
That they've been showing for like a year. And there's the sketch of this character from behind that that isn't a frame of the movie. It's just a sketch of.
Right.
Kind of a concept of how the character's supposed to look. So
Jackson said that the Polygon shared an image, so I muted Polygon. Fuck around and find out. Polygon, I'm never seeing your tweets ever again.
Fair enough.
Ever.
I think, I'm sure they'll be heartbroken.
Yeah. Oh no, ISO Christian? Anyway. that's it for Real Roundup. If we miss anything, feel free to shout us over on Twitter. And if any other big news breaks for The Boy and the Heron, stick around. Because we may just talk about it on our next episode. And that's it for all our short segments. Now let's see what's on the marquee with today's topic of the show. The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. A film for all the young lovers of the world. A young French couple is separated by the war in Algiers. Of course, Umbrellas of Cherbourg, directed by Jacques Demy, written by Jacques Demy, and there's actually some co-directors, some additional directors of the movie that I wanted to include as well. Jean-Paul Savignac, Klaus Müller-Loh, that's a German name. I'm trying my best. Don't even look at me. I don't even want to see your face right now. And André Frédéric. Shout out to them.
Shout out. I love my favorite one is André. Yes. Not André. André. That
dude,
guy.
It's like midnight over here, man. I'm sweating. It's like 80 degrees over here. That means nothing to you. Anyway.
Jacques Demy, Agne Varda's husband.
Yes.
If you didn't know.
Yes. Also, Jacques Demy. Of course, we did. We picked this movie in like partly in preparation for Barbie prep. If you check that Letterboxd video where Greta Gerwig discusses a lot of her inspirations for Barbie, Jacques Demy is like massive, and not just in terms of like the color, but also like wardrobe and more specifically the way, as Greta Gerwig puts it, the way Jacques Demy constructs his worlds and has like rules to it. Which I think fit very well for a world made from Mattel toys. Makes a lot of sense. As Hugo is always like blowing his nose. For, like the past month, he's just blowing his nose all the time.
Dude, I have hay fever, and there was a tweet going around. You know how some people have like a little bit of a headache and they'll take 15 pills, and some people just refuse to use medicine?
I'm Mexican. Yeah, I'm Mexican.
I'm the second kind. So it's like I'm not even tested for allergies. Like I don't even know, but I know that I have them. So I should be taking something for it, but I just can't be bothered. And so for 3 months a year, I'm just in this horrible state, especially in the morning. Like it goes away throughout the day. So yeah,
I've been having heart palpitations for weeks. Here I am recording a pod.
Yeah. That's what you do.
That's what you do. Some trivia here for you before we get into discussion. The Umbrella Shop, the one from the movie, still exists on this 13 rue de Port.
Oh, what the fuck? Cherbourg. I should go there.
Let's go. Let's buy an umbrella. And it's marked with a plaque that commemorates the film.
Awesome. I'm going to look up where this is.
I just told you.
I have to
go. It's on 13 rue de Port. Look up
Cherbourg. I don't know. I don't know where the city of Cherbourg is exactly.
And of course, if you watch the movie, you'll very clearly see that it's inspired, Damien Chazelle, director, inspired by it. And of course, he has cited the film as a principal source of inspiration for his Oscar-winning film, La La Land.
Which, yeah, once you see it, it's like, oh, this is the story is very, has a lot of parallels to La La Land, for sure.
But I like La La Land more. I'm going to say it. Start of the show.
Me too.
Even though I enjoyed this, I ended up enjoying this. And this is where we start the discussion. Hugo, before we started the movie, you said, I mean, look, people who know me, people who know you, know that we are preferers of non-musical movies. I'll put it that way, right? And listen, that's not to say we won't watch a musical, but it's just not our preferred kind of storytelling. We ended up, Hugo texted me, we ended up picking one that is entirely a musical. They sing the entire time. And I was like, fuck.
Yeah. There's no spoken dialogue. Like all the, and it's weird because like it's a musical, but it's very different from American musicals.
Yeah.
Like
there's no numbers.
There's no dance numbers. Like they don't dance in this movie at all. I mean, there's a scene where they go dancing, but like, it's not a dance number, you know what I mean? It's just two people on a date going to a place where you dance. And there's actually only like a few actual songs, if you know what I mean. For the most part, people just, in a way that you would speak dialogue, instead of speaking it, they sing it in notes. It's kind of hard to explain what I mean until you see the movie. But once you've seen it, it's like, yeah, for the most part, they're not actually singing. There's a few songs that are that you could take that as a track and listen to it on Spotify. But other than that, it's like, you know what I mean? Other than that, it's mostly just people speaking in notes, which is an interesting choice.
Someone is
Did it work for you?
Someone's going to stop me on the street. Hey, what are you listening to? Huh? Oh, Act 1, Scene 3 from Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Mama! Did it work for me? that's a good question.
God, that would be funny.
Did it work for me? Good. Did it work for me is a great question because, yes, but it took a while for me for it to work. And I mean a good while. I think not until the end of, it's separated into three parts. Until the end of part one is where I think it finally kind of clicked a bit for me. Those first 30 minutes, I was like, this is not really my kind of film, and I'm going to disappoint Hannah for sure. It was a little bit of a struggle, but I mean, art should challenge us in different ways, and I think the interplay of the music itself and the like singing, I guess, took a while for it to settle in. And once it did, and once like the narrative kind of took more of a center, that's when everything kind of clicked in. It ended up being, actually, I ended up enjoying it more than I thought I would.
I think the actual score to the movie is amazing.
Yep. Like that theme that they keep playing.
The main theme is incredible. The musical number attached to that, where they're in this cafe saying goodbye and actually singing the song. That's just one of the greatest sequences I've ever seen in a movie, where he jumps on the train and the camera just sticks with the train and she becomes very small in the platform. That's just incredible filmmaking. It did get a bit tiring. Like, if I have to hear somebody else very slowly sing au revoir again, I'm going to kill myself. But
do you like my Letterboxd review? if I had an edible in Cherbourg, I think I'd kill myself. I can handle it, dude.
Like, I feel like it's weird. It's a weird experience to just hear people singing normal lines and not songs. It creates kind of, for me at least, it created a bit of a distance.
Yes.
Like, I wasn't fully emotionally invested in everything that was happening because I was kind of distracted by, oh, suddenly you're singing in a falsetto just to say mom. And it's like, okay, this is a bit much. But I appreciate it. Like, it's definitely a very interesting thing that I've never seen before in this way. Because again, American musicals are completely different. It's like there'll be dialogue sequences where they just speak. And then there'll be songs where the reality of the movie is heightened. There's a musical number, or there's you know, everybody in LA stops in the streets and starts dancing outside of their car while they're stuck in traffic, you know? In this, people go about their day as they would in normal movie scenes, but they sing through it. So it is kind of weird. So it didn't work. There are moments where it's very good, very beautiful what it does, and there are moments where it's like a bit distracting.
The distancing is an interesting one, because I also felt the same way, but I think it was the specific use of like, you have to write a certain way if you're going to have these songs be rhyming and then be like singing, so it, like, you have to format what would be otherwise like lines or prose, like of mm-hmm, spoken mm-hmm. dialogue differently. And it makes for, like, it does add to the theatricality of it, but it kind of changes the way, I guess, I prefer, like, emotional scenes to kind of play out, where there are, like, pauses and spaces and, like, words, just overall sentences are kind of longer and you get to sit with those emotions. In here, it's very much like one person says a line, it's pretty much matter-of-factly, and the emotion, like, the words aren't as charged as, like, regular dialogue, and then the other person responds with, you know, more sing-songy, and so that is where I was finding the most distance from, like, I just moment-to-moment scenes, and that was, I think, my mm-hmm. biggest struggle with, like, attaching myself to the narrative. I think it's a testament, though, to the actual overarching, like, I don't know, I found myself caring for, oh, I should absolutely look up the characters, Catherine, Genevieve, and what's his name?
Guy.
Yeah, their actual relationship, yeah, the struggles of it, I think ended up really resonating with me, and that's the testament to the actual, like, writing of the actual romance. So
I think the narrative is really strong, and I think that's where I enjoyed the movie so much. I think the visuals are incredible. Like, I wish movies could look like this. I was talking about this before. It just looks so beautiful all the time. Production design, just everything, just incredible. The actual story is really, really, really affecting, really good. I love the structure. And it comes to a conclusion that is heartbreaking, but also so very real. And where I wasn't fully connecting to the movie is literally just because, like, I was a bit distracted a lot of the time. By the choice of all the dialogue being sung.
We'll talk about the production design here in a little bit, but I want to actually start with the camera. You notice how baller some of these, like, camera movements are?
Oh yeah,
like the beginning title sequence with like the people like walking with the umbrellas, like that camera's like moving up and down, left and right. But even like moving through scenes where it's like we're like staring at this end of the room, and then like they go backwards and then pull you into the table and then around. It's like it is floating through the entire movie. And I don't know. I found myself, I guess, if you're gonna be a feature length song musical thing, I think floating through the scene makes sense for this kind of movie. And I felt it.
Yeah, and it really put you in these locations. Like the reality of the movie is so heightened because obviously, like, all the colors are extremely bright. Everyone's singing all the time, and yet the camera makes it feel like a real place because you're walking down the streets with the character and turning a corner and you know, literally going from one shop to the next and following them there, and it's like, to the point where I wasn't always sure what was a set and what was just the actual street of some town in France.
Sure.
Which I thought was very impressive because sometimes these older movies, like, for instance, if you watch Singing in the Rain, very popular American musical.
I've heard of it.
It's very obvious when they're just on a set. Like,
sure.
It's very, very artificial in that way. And this isn't. There's moments where they're like, oh, maybe that's a real auto shop, a mechanic. I'm not sure whether they built this or not. Because then the camera pulls back and suddenly you're in the street and there's no cuts. And all that stuff worked really well. And again, the color palette for me is what is the best part of the production design.
Yeah, we'll talk about color here in a second. I want to bring up one more thing that I thought was really cool. For no reason. There's a moment when Guy and Jean-Vier are not wanting to say goodbye. And instead of walking through the street, he's got his bike with him. They're standing still, but they're on some kind of like platform and they're like moving through it, even though they're
floating.
Just standing still.
Yeah,
literally floating. And then they like come to a stop. I would assume they like get off whatever little thing on wheels they were on and they start walking. It's like, God, that's a cool movie. Just movie magic. Right
there. It takes you. Something unreal is happening. It's like they're so in love that they're floating through the street and yeah, that's a cool moment.
I'm thinking about the colors you just mentioned as well. Did you have a favorite wall? Because I did. I can tell you my favorite wall, and it's the one outside, I think it's Guy's house, that's like nothing but like pink, and then on the left side of the wall it's like this like streak of like black and white. I don't know, like I'm so used to like these boring American modernized houses that I forget, like, well, first of all, it's like the world of Cherbourg is like wonderfully realized and the color looks great, but also like Europeans, I forget, these motherfuckers do have color inside their homes as well. Like there's some pretty houses on the inside, and all these houses in Cherbourg look gorgeous.
There's that wall going into the building where Aunt Elise's apartment is, Guy's aunt. That is just bright green. And there's cracks in it. And, you know, it's a very working class place. Like, it's kind of falling apart. It's not totally renewed and stuff. But it's still bright green inside. Which is very cool. And it's like... But the movie is all like that. It'll have a slab of very... Like, inside the shop, it's bright, you know, very strong red. And, you know, for the most part, Genevieve wears... You know, bright pink clothes, and the bicycle is a bright yellow, and it's all sort of like that.
Catherine Deneuve, she was 19 when she made this movie, and I gotta say, seeing her in this, and immediately I was like, yeah, I see why Greta Gerwig cited this as like a Barbie inspiration. They're putting her in outfits that are very much like, that is a straight up Barbie doll if I've ever seen one. And first of all, she's also just like a gorgeous person as well.
Yeah. Yeah, she got recognition for this, and then she was in a bunch of other movies. Like she's in in a Lars von Trier movie, she's in a Buñuel movie, she's in the Young Girls of Rochefort, which is the other famous movie by Jacques Demy. You know, she did a bunch of things, even outside of France, after this.
And I'm only
she's really good. I think performances overall, everyone was quite good.
Yeah, even the supporting cast. I don't think I had any sort of character where I felt like they weren't. Yeah, I think there's. I think if I have to pick a kind of supporting cast member that I kind of liked, and I honestly wanted a bit more of was Madeline, the caretaker of mm-hmm. Aunt Elise.
Yeah.
There's a certain kind of melancholia to that, like her as a caretaker that we don't kind of get a window into until mm-hmm. honestly part three. And I think having a bit more on her even would have been a bit stronger and set up maybe a stronger part three for me. I don't know.
She kind of serves the narrative more than have her own
sure
role in it.
Yeah. Which is a bit unfortunate.
And there is a thing with musicals that I always say, that grand emotional choices are made on a whim. There aren't, like, it's kind of less realistic than, oh, we're, you know, fucking West Side Story. We meet tonight. We're in love forever. We'll die for each other in 3 days. You know, it's very heightened from what, you know, movies that aren't musicals usually do. And, you know, in the third act, when he marries Madeleine, it seems like a little sudden. But it works as a narrative overall because of what it's saying thematically about the two main characters that we're following, which are Guy and Genevieve. And I like that they each get their own act where the other is barely in it.
That's true. Yeah. Part two and part three. Yeah, that's very true. Yeah.
Let's talk about the structure as well.
Oh, you first then. What do you got on the structure?
Like the movie specifically calls out part one, the departure, and it gives you a date as well, November 57. Part two, the absence, where he goes off to, basically he's called off to war by conscription. Like he doesn't have a choice, has to go to Algeria to, you know, this is the time in the 50s where the decolonization was happening. So the French were trying to keep Algeria colonized. So mm-hmm, I mean, obviously the movie doesn't go into that, but you know, that's the reason why he's supposed to go to war. And in this sequence, he's barely in it. There's a few letters by him. There's a photo, but I don't think we actually see him in the movie. And it's just about her. And then in the third sequence, the return, he comes back. And, you know, the story unfolds. I think I'm sure we'll talk about specifically what happens. But I like the way that it calls out each part of the film. And it's interesting that the departure, which is the first part, is basically the first half of the movie. It's almost half the movie is like 40 minutes. And then the other two parts are a little faster. Because the big thing is these two young people, they fall in love. And then he's called away and he's forced to go to war, but she's pregnant because they make love for the first time the night before he has to leave, and she becomes pregnant, but he has to leave and he doesn't get to be there. And I think for me, that's the part of the movie that worked best, is the first
really
act. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. First act. Yeah, the first act is for me the strongest. I think there's a bit more I wanted in part two and part three, where I felt like it kind of moved a bit too quick.
It moved a bit fast. Yeah.
Afterwards. Yeah. I want to talk about Genevieve in part two because you brought it up. And I'm thinking of the context of the whole movie, where, like you mentioned earlier, the result that, you know, the La La Land esque ending. I shouldn't have said it that way. This is La La Land, whatever. It's rooted in a tragedy, but it's still very much like this is real life. This is what kind of like people drift apart, whatever, people end up building lives with other people. That's just the sad reality that sometimes first loves don't work out. Usually they don't work out. But there's also like a moment or like a part of me that's in this heightened world. And maybe that's the strongest of it, you know, in this kind of colorful world, even still real life with tragedy. I really wished I could have gotten a bit more on how quick she was to leave this man, because part two starts 3 to 4 months after his initial departure. And yeah. She mentions that he hasn't been writing all that much. And to me, I was like, oh, this is like, that's going to come into play later. Like maybe someone is holding the letters or, you know, he's like stationed somewhere else where they can't mail them out, and she's gonna have to wait longer than she wants to. But then she's like, get your bag, sis. But I don't know, man, like, you're pregnant with this kid. I wish you would have waited a bit more, a bit longer to get some more letters before just like committing to this weirdo.
I think the movie is very aware of the cultural norms,
sure,
of the time. She's young and pregnant, and yeah, a big plot point in the movie that her and her mother, who is widowed, I'm not sure, the father isn't in the picture, but we don't really get to know exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. They have this umbrella shop. The Umbrellas of Cherbourg is the titular, yeah, shop they work in.
Yeah. Tunisia shop.
Yeah, and it's not going completely well. They're in financial trouble. They have to sell their own jewelry and stuff. And she's pregnant and young. And at one point, there's a line that she says is like, oh, if he's willing to take me, even knowing that I'm pregnant from somebody else, I would be stupid to refuse.
Sure.
Which underlines this idea that women... still in the late 1950s in France were, you know, marriage was also a transactional thing. Mm-hmm. They had to look for financial stability through marriage. And it may be a way to look at it that we don't totally relate to anymore. And it seems, you know, mm-hmm, well, you know, but you were in love with this other guy, so why couldn't you wait? But like, in that moment in time, that's the societal pressure, the cultural norm that you have to face is, oh, you're pregnant, you must get married and have security, which is still a thing today, by the way. It's not like something that's completely gone.
My problem is that I'm too romantic. You know what I mean? Like when I'm at the ending and like, God, I'm going to spoil for the ending. I don't know. Whatever. We're jumping around.
Yeah, yeah.
When it's revealed that, you know, she names the kid, the daughter, what he wanted to name the boy, but it's the female version, Francoise.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's such a sadness to her eyes when she's like looking at the shop, and it's like, you could have waited a bit longer. You could have been happy together.
Yeah, because ultimately he comes back with the idea that he, you know, he went to war and he came back and he will now take care of her and be with her. And she's just gone. Like when he gets mm-hmm. back, the scene where he returns, he's back at the station where we had this big climatic, you know, scene where they say goodbye and he goes to the shop and the shop isn't there anymore. The shop just isn't there anymore. And he doesn't know much about her. Apparently after the wedding, she just leaves, goes to live in Paris.
I would have cried so hard.
I mean, he does. Like, he becomes depressed.
Harder.
True. Well, there's not a lot of runtime left at that point.
Yeah, yeah. I guess there's like 30 minutes, I think. A little bit less. But yeah.
No, that's something. Mm-hmm. You know, the shop is gone. He basically goes back to this other woman, Madeleine, who had been taking care of his aunt, who at this point also dies. He was his old aunt he lived with. And they get together, they have a kid, and he calls the kid, who's a boy, Francois, and Geneviève had called the girl that she had from him, but raising her with the other guy, Francoise. And yeah, it's this very sad scene. Like, it also does seem, though, that in the end, his life is happier than hers.
Mm.
You know, like, it does seem to me like she's the one who had to make a hard choice that ultimately led her to not be as happy as she would have been with him. And he is the one who didn't get the choice, but was able to move on fully. Like, the final scene is him playing with his kids.
Yeah.
Whereas with her, the final scene is her going to this place and, you know, refilling mm-hmm. her car and reminiscing about this person she used to be in love with and whose child she has with her.
I think the most devastating thing about that scene right before that is like the final words he kind of speaks to her is she asks, like, do you want to meet her? It's his kid. Mm-hmm. Biologically, that's his kid, right? And he kind of looks over for a second, looks at her from afar while they're inside and she's in the car, and he just shakes his head no. Says, mm-hmm. you should go. That bro is still hurt. Oh, yeah. And that left me a little bit in shambles. Like, it's just devastating, man.
He's hurt, and at the same time, he's moved on. Like, he doesn't want to reopen that wound.
You can't. He can't, like, right? Yeah.
Like, at that point, it's, yes, it's biologically his kid, but she left. Like, she was the one
she
who
left. She left.
Left, and, you know, even though she was probably forced to by the circumstances, by cultural norms, again, by the difficulties she was having with her mother, but you know,
yeah.
At that point, meeting her would be hard. But it's interesting how, similar to La La Land as well, yes, they don't end up together, but they had a profound impact on each other's mm-hmm. life, mm-hmm. enough to call their children the same name. You know, like, there's still, it's tragic. But at the same time, you know, life goes on, and those experiences still shape you in both positive and negative ways. I think that's what the movie is.
Yeah. Doing. The thing for me about
also Lala, pretty cool that he has a little model. Sorry, this is random, but he has a little model of an Esso gas station and mechanic mm-hmm. in his room, and he opens an Esso gas station and auto shop later. That's cool.
Wasn't a big fan of his room. Seemed too boyish for me. He's 20. Get real. Why are you Frenchman? The thing about me for La La Land is, like, that ending is dramatic, right? But there's, like, a mutual understanding where it hurts, like, knowing that they'll never be together. But there's, like, there's the smile when they look at it over at each other, Ryan Gosling and, mm-hmm. and Emma Stone. They're aware of their impact, and they're aware that, like, they are living their best lives by being not together. And this was the complete opposite for me. Or, like, that was very much rooted in that tragedy, where I felt like both ends even were just hurting.
In La La Land, yes, there is it's bittersweet, but they're both.
This is bitter.
Kind of living the dream that they had,
yeah,
and they had to sacrifice that relationship, but in a way, it's still a positive ending for both of them, and in this, it's a bit more.
What I'm trying to say is that I led us astray, and I thought I was picking us a happier movie, and it still wasn't, dude. We cannot get away. First, it was horny movies, and now it's just depressing movies.
Yeah. Apparently, the other one, the Young Girls of Rushford, is like a comedy.
We were this close to getting some happy.
And we were like, nah, that's 2 hours long. Too much singing.
Too much singing. If only we knew. If only we had the hindsight.
If only we knew. Yeah, yeah. That's true. Yeah, but yeah, I'm interested in watching that now, though, that I've seen this.
Young Girls of Mushroom. Sure. Yeah,
more so than it would have been. Great movie. Very good movie. I think didn't connect to me fully just because of the singing thing. But. Definitely a stunning piece of work. Like we've talked about the camera work, the production design, the music. The music, that main theme is so good.
Very good.
Such a beautiful, romantic, but devastating theme.
That peak one, like, sorry, peak one. Act one, part one, like, ending is, like, crushing. Perfect. It's perfect. Yeah, so good.
You could have ended the movie there, and it would have been wow.
Yeah.
Stunning.
It would have been wow.
Yeah.
Put it on
wow.
The letterbox. Yeah, I'm with you. I think, personally, in terms of enjoyment, I think, you know, this is so stupid of me to say, but I'm more on the 3.5 side of things. Mm-hmm. When I think about, like, the movie magic, when I think about the like, as you said, the composition, the cinematography, the production design, all of it, like, is working so efficiently throughout the 90 minute runtime that I can't help but elevate it to, like, that 4-star. Like, no, this is actually a great movie. If I think about this movie at any point in my life later on, I'll think, no, it's still a great movie. I don't prefer it to as much as, you know, the things I'm usually into, but it's still a great movie.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, 4 stars for me as well. It beautiful film. Very happy to have seen it. And yeah, I hope it informs my viewing of Barbie in some way.
It probably will. It's no Moonfall, though. All right. It's no Moonfall. We've done Iran. We've gone to South Korea. June 37th? What am I going on about here? June, what is 27th?
I don't know, dude. We just, Americans write dates weird. Maybe you have 37 days of the month. It wouldn't surprise me.
I'm forgetting something here, but
weird calculating numbers and measurements. Oh, I'm having 2 ounces of this. Shut up, bitch.
We went to Japan, and we are now leaving France. Where are we going to? Excuse me. Where are we going to?
You
next?
Good?
I'm good. Okay. my heart hurts a little bit, but yeah, I'm good.
Okay. I did this a bit differently. I have a bunch of European movies that I would like to see, and I filtered out my watch list by comedy. slash sure. Thriller. I went thrillers and comedies. I was like, let's try not to get depressing this time. And I have a few options to throw your way, and you tell me which sounds more interesting. I have a Czech movie. I think at the time it was Czechoslovakia, now it would be the Czech Republic. It's called Daisies, 1966. It's like a surrealist feminist comedy, and it was banned by the government at the time because it was too subversive. Very 76 minutes, apparently very weird, very cool movie. It's about two teenage girls who go on this like weird like prank spree on men, and it's a very surrealist feminist comedy is what is described at. Sounds cool. Second, I have, if we don't want to go depressing but we want to go fucked up, I have the Polish movie Possession.
Ooh.
Which is a horror film. Actually, I mean, the director is Polish, but the movie is in French, produced in France and Germany, so it would be in French again, but it, you know, Polish director. Then I have Spain, going to Spain, Almodovar, Volver, 2006, with Penelope Cruz, which I believe neither of us have seen.
Nope.
Right? You haven't seen this one?
I have not seen it.
This is also listed as a comedy romance drama. So obviously it'll have some melodramatic elements because it's Almodovar, but it's also a comedy. This would be a little more upbeat from the tragic films we've been seeing. And this has this apparently has an element of magical realism to it, which I thought sounded interesting. And there's also this movie from Germany, Victoria.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I know this movie. Yep,
2015. It's like a crime.
I've seen it.
Crime thriller type movie, and it is entirely in one shot and not stitched together. It is entirely shot in one take. Like they actually did the whole movie in one take.
I've seen this movie, and the beginning of it is incredible.
I think it. Oh, you've seen it?
I saw it in high school, and I literally only remember the beginning because, you know, when you're watching a movie with friends in high school,
you don't have it logged on Letterboxd, is what I mean.
So yeah, that's why I didn't log it.
Yeah, these are the four that I was thinking of. I was thinking of sticking to Europe, but not entirely sure where we might want to go. It's interesting. Daisies seems cool, and it's 76 minute long if we're in the mood for something shorter. But we could also go for a melodrama or a horror or a, you know, kind of a more experimental one take thing.
When you said,
what are your thoughts?
When you said Possession, I'm like, yes, it's got to be Possession. But you did make the good point that we just did a French movie, and this one's also in French, even though it's a Polish movie.
Yes.
And then you said Almodovar, Spain. And I was like, dude, anytime, man. Almodovar movies are so good. Like, we got to do that one. And you said Victoria, dude. And Victoria is fucking cool. From what I remember nothing, almost nothing of it. I'm between Victoria and Volver.
And Volver, yeah. God, that's a tough one, isn't it? I mean, Victoria sounds insane.
Yeah, let's do girl. Let's get on our hot girl shit. Little girly summer. Victoria.
Victoria. Okay, so the premise is young Spanish woman was newly moved to Berlin, finds a flirtation with a local girl turned potentially deadly as their night out with his friend reveals a dangerous secret. And it's like a, yeah, crime thriller romance thing.
Fun fact.
All in one shot.
The first video essay I ever made, I used the opening music from Victoria.
Cool. So a more recent pick for once. 2015. There you go.
Also, I can have it in high school. Anyway.
Germany.
Da. That's not... That wasn't German, I think.
That's Russian.
That's... Woo! We going to Germany, baby!
Great. Awesome.
Mm-hmm. All right, 2 weeks, Victoria. Next week, Barbenheimer. We'll see you at the movies. Cool. All right. That's going to do it for this episode. We hope you enjoyed today's show. Remember to give us a sub to stay up to date with all our cinema thoughts here on Large Popcorn. Until next time, thank you, Ryan Johnson. Long live Chloe Zhao. And Denis, we trust.
Insert a person very slowly singing au revoir here.
Au revoir, Shoshana.